lesbian activist Wanda Alston. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And indeed, we are building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Good morning. Thanks to all who came out. You are in tune to WPFW Washington.
So-called slavery, desecration of African graves, and the failure of 21st century democratic politics. The U.S. and Israel have openly embarked on a war with Iran. Have we forgotten Gaza? Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. My segment of What's at Stake airs every fourth Wednesday of the month. Today, I'm honored to have two scholar activists with me to discuss. First, a brilliant article by writer John Jeter and anti-war activist John Steinbeck. Our first conversation is with journalist John Jeter. John is twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He is a former Washington Post foreign correspondent, former producer for the popular radio documentary program, This American Life, and the author of several books, including his most recent, Class War in America, How the Elites Divide the Nation, by asking, are you a worker or are you white? Good morning, John. Your article entitled Unearthed Bones Reveal a Graveyard for Maryland's Enslaved, a funeral pie for Democrats nationwide. It goes on, activists accuse Congressman Jamie Raskin of failing to protect cemetery that contains the remains of sex trafficked slave girls. This article was published in Black Republic Media. And I must note, it is highly recommended reading. Can you tell us what prompted you to write this article?
Well, succinctly, you did, Marsha. And the activities of BACC, the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, which I have known about for many years through both you and my friend, several friends, actually. And we are trying to relaunch Black Republic Media, which is a news outlet that really talks about the Black community in intimate ways. And this was a natural place to relaunch or rebrand Black Republic Media. The election had just happened. We were hearing about Congressman Jamie Raskin, who many people, I think, across the country know as a kind of a liberal icon already, even though he's fairly young to be that. He's kind of known as a liberal icon. And yet I heard about how he hadn't really lifted a finger to help the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition deal with this issue, which would seem a no-brainer, would seem not a very heavy lift, particularly in Montgomery County, which is a liberal stronghold, a Democratic stronghold. Doesn't seem like there would be too heavy a cost for a politician to pay to help an organization like yours. Well, there aren't many organizations like yours, quite frankly. There should be, but there aren't. But to help an organization like BACC deal with this issue, which doesn't seem like it should be, shouldn't be too heavily contested.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate this. The article is absolutely brilliant. I've sent it to almost everyone that I know on the globe at this point. And what I loved about the article is that you place this issue in the context of power politics, of global trade, and international white supremacy. And so if you don't mind, I just wanted to give our listeners a quick tutorial on this issue. So Africans were at the center of global trade and finance in the 16th century and even before. It was their labor, sweat, and blood that financed the great houses of wealth, both in the United States and Europe. Every pair of pants, every dress, this is before polyester, was made of cotton. And those pants and dresses worn from New York to Sweden had the blood of African people on them. The same with tobacco that was grown in Virginia and Maryland, and in particular on River Road in Bethesda. So what I loved about your article is that you linked the downward spiral that led from tobacco production and cotton being essential to the United States becoming eventually a superpower to the most important cash crops, which became Black women's wombs. Essentially, Black women's wombs, our wombs, became a cash crop in this country. So can you discuss that?
Yeah, one of the things that really got me interested in the story, one of the many things that really got me interested, was the story of the tobacco farms, particularly in Maryland and Virginia. Tobacco is a really hard crop to grow, and I've known this for years. I've heard this years ago, that it exhausts the soil, it coarsens the soil, makes it hard to sort of replicate the bountiful harvest year after year. So what these plantation owners would do, particularly again in Maryland and Virginia, which were tobacco dominant, they would start to lease out their male slaves to carpenters and ship owners and things like that. Because of course, you know, a slave was there to make money. And that's a lesson that we should understand even today. But the women, what they would do, particularly after they banned slavery, the United States banned slavery in 1808 or 1809, I can't remember now, after they banned the importation of slaves, that meant that homegrown slaves became really quite valuable. And so many of these tobacco crops or tobacco plantations became slave breeding farms, where that's all they did. They didn't produce any other crops. They bred slaves. They would do some of the most horrendous things to women, some of them as young as 13 years old. And I think you don't have to be a doctor to understand a 13-year-old girl should not be having babies. It's very hard on her. Many of these children, that's what they were, children who were used as breeders, died in childbirth. And of course, the slave owner didn't care anything about their bodies. They would just dump them in a field somewhere. Well, that for an African, you don't have to be African to understand this. Africans really respect the dead, right? Their ancestors. That is a huge deal. And so they had to bury these slaves somewhere. So they would take these bodies, many of whom were young girls who were dumped in this field, and they would give them a proper burial. That became the basis for the cemeteries for enslaved people. In many places, but particularly in the River Road community, it became a cemetery for enslaved people. Informal at first. After slavery, it became a formal cemetery. And of course, then the developers came. The point to me that I found so compelling is the, it almost defines Black life in America since the moment we arrived, and whether you date that back to 1619 or before, which is that we don't have we don't have agency over our own lives and our own bodies unless we fight for it. Mm-hmm. From cradle to the grave, white people determine pretty much everything about our existence, where we live, whether we live, or how we die, how much money we're going to make, how much they're going to pay us, what we teach our children. This is all something that's decided for us, unless we really, really fight, as BACC is doing. So I thought that was really the central point, right? And these people who say they're going to help us, with a few exceptions historically, right, they don't really help us. They're not making a sincere or good faith effort to help us. And that seemed to me the central point, not just of the story, but of Black life in America for more than 400 years.
You know, we now have research, John, that shows that these, we call them terrorists, the people who held us, who kidnapped us on these what we call death camps, were not only impregnating 10, 11-year-old girls, but they were actually renting out girls as young as 4 years old. And these girls survived because, and we know they survived because we know some of their relatives in the 21st century. So these girls somehow, after being rented out at 4 years old, and Harriet Tubman was rented out at 4 years old. I mean, so
I did not know that. This was a practice.
And so, you know, we were looking at census reports in 1860, John Councilman, who had one of the largest quote unquote death camps on River Road, had a 26-year-old female, 16-year-old female, 3-year-old female, 18-year-old female. So you look at these, what they call schedules, and it's full of girls. It's full of women. You know that they are not the primary producers of tobacco. I mean, that's one of the ways we began to think about this. And then if you look at the Posey death camp, 4 year old, 5 years old, 7 years old, 28 years old. I mean, these were all young girls whose bodies were being torn apart. So your article becomes, you know, essential because it's a part of our history that no one wants to talk about. And that is the way these girls' bodies were just being totally destroyed. And they would succumb and bleed out. And then, of course, they would die. One of the statistics that you quoted that, you know, left me breathless, quite frankly, is that you said that between 10,000 and 20,000 slaves every month, not yearly, every month were being sent to the South. So that meant that all these babies, 20,000 to 30,000 children are being produced and are available to be sold every month. I mean, can you comment on that? What was happening in our community that we're producing just in Maryland now, I assume every month, I assume you're talking about Maryland, Virginia. I mean, that many women are producing babies to be sent to the South? That's unbelievable.
You know, you just can't, and I'm 60 years old now, and I've always been familiar with these ideas and these narratives, right? I grew up in a household where we, you know, my father was, I think we would call him a race man back in our day, Marcia, but you can't overstate the monstrousness of slavery, of the institution of slavery, the sell of Black people, human beings, right, to other human beings who are forced then to work at gunpoint. You just can't overstate the horror of that. And I really want to try to bring that home because in modern life, with all this technology and the devaluation of the written word, right, we don't often convey the horror of that, right? We talk about reparations as a check. What kind of check can make us whole after we learn these stories, African Americans learn these stories of how we were treated, right? I think the breeding of women during this period of time is similar to, in my mind, to the horrors suffered by the Congolese at the hands of King Leopold in Belgium, who were forced to farm rubber. They cut their hands off to make them work, or they killed their children or their wives to make these Africans work. And so I just was hoping to bring the horror home, and right, and the idea that even after you've been enslaved and forced to work at gunpoint, and the women have been sexually assaulted repeatedly as a matter of course, that we're not allowed to rest, right? The irony that the slave owner wants us dead, but not particularly buried, right? Or not buried especially, right? that we are, after all, whether the chief product of the United States is cotton, cars, or credit, we are like, at this moment, like 40, 45 million ATM machine from which white people are entitled to extract money, cash, right? That's what we are. That's how we're treated. We don't own or control any institution in this country, and that is by design, with the exception maybe of a few small churches like yours, like Macedonia. We don't own or control any institutions in this country, and that is the afterlife of slavery that we almost never mention, despite we have all this communications technology, but we never talk about. This is still how Black people are living in this country. We owned, when Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, it's estimated that Black people, who represented about 13% of the country, of the population, owned about 0.5% of all assets nationwide. In 2025, we represent about 13% of the population, and we own about 1% of all assets in the country. Nothing's changed, right? Nothing, or very little has changed anyway. Obama didn't change it, and we really do need to have an honest conversation about reparations. What is owed? What is the debt that America owes its Black citizens?
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, you think about, you know, in all kinds of excuses, the trauma, the lack of resources to lift oneself up out of this kind of mire. But the institutionalization of Black people being, as you said, like ATM machines, or the Black womb that, you know, even our bodies just produce on behalf of white supremacy, is so essential here. And I love the story that you told in, about, you know, this woman named Louisa Everett, who told researchers during the Work Progress Administration about, you know, how she and this other Black man were forced to publicly have sex in front of this white man to make sure that they were, in fact, producing, that their bodies were being like the ATM machine, that she was going to produce for, on behalf of his corporation, his plantation, more people. He says, they told him they must get busy and do it in his presence, right? So between this period of history, 16th, 17th, 18th, and the 21st century, I mean, which is what your article does. You blend all of this together. You talk about the institutionalization of this, and you link the terror that our ancestors face and the desecration. I mean, you're right. All these little girls who were forced to have children whose bodies were not prepared, they bleed out, they die at 10, 11 years old. And now in the 21st century, you have American politicians like, you know, sort of the, you know, the Jamie Raskin, who's considered the darling, I think it's fair to say, of the Democratic Party. And they're still denying that any of this took place and refusing to even acknowledge the atrocity that was committed on American soil. So, first of all, who is Jamie Raskin? You started talking about him. And what is his position on Moses Cemetery and this intergenerational story that you're talking about?
Yeah, Jamie Raskin is a Democratic lawmaker, congressman from Montgomery County, Maryland. Montgomery County being a suburb of Washington, D.C., is a bastion of, I think it's safe to say, white liberalism. It's known as for its white liberal politicians, right? But on this issue, Raskin, who I think his father worked for the Kennedy administration, he went to Harvard. He has a very Kennedy-esque resume, right? He was the what helped me out here. He was the chair of the one of the impeachment trials against Trump. I believe he was the chair of that, right? Which is where he gained his high profile. He is fairly well spoken. He looks the look. If you called up Central Casting and said, give me a white liberal politician in the Kennedy mold, Jamie Raskin looks the part, and he's a sympathetic figure. He lost a son a few years ago, an adult son to suicide, if I can say that. He's very open about it. And so he's a sympathetic character. He's, I think it's easy to say, it's fair to say he's a likable white liberal, right? But like most white liberals, as Blacks come to understand them, most being as in, I'd say 90%, right? Historically even, because liberalism was created essentially to defang radicalism and leftism. He talks the talk, but he doesn't walk the walk when it comes to Black people in Montgomery County. One of your members told me that, you know, there have been several Black men killed by the police over the years in Montgomery mm-hmm. County, as there have been across the nation. And Congressman Raskin hasn't had a lot to say about them or about police reform, right? And on this issue, I interviewed one of his aides who said, you know, she gave me a statement that she prepared. And she said, you know, we support BACC. We find what they're doing. We find that what they're doing is really stunning and something that we should all support. And we'll continue to support their efforts. But of course, as you pointed out, you know, it's just lip service. It's not a lot of there. There's nothing materially happening on the ground that is pushed by Congressman Raskin that is resulting in something material being done about these bones that are being dug up of our ancestors by this developer, right? And of course, anyone who's familiar with the Washington, D.C. area knows that the developers, particularly in Maryland, the developers are to Maryland and Northern Virginia what the big three automakers are to Michigan and Detroit, right? They really run this thing. And I guess that's the speculation. That's all we can do is speculate as to why Congressman Raskin hasn't done more. It would be a heck of a public relations coup were he to come out with you guys and announce that you've actually been able to sort of be able to announce something material. But he just won't do that. And that's, you know, you might have even mentioned that none of the politicians on any level in Montgomery County have really helped BACC restore the cemetery in any material way. I just think that speaks to the Democratic Party. Raskin is a microcosm of the Democratic Party, the embodiment of it in 2025, where they are really stuck, right? They have for the last 30, 32 years, I would say, dating back to Bill Clinton, they have maintained this constituency of African-Americans. The most loyal constituents are African-Americans. But at the same time, since Clinton, they have made a clear appeal to white voters, particularly white racist suburban voters who voted for Reagan or whose parents voted for Reagan. They made the appeal. See, we won't do anything for them, though, right? And they're stuck right now, and they don't know how to get out of it. Let's see what happens with this young man in New York City who just won the primary. I guess he's winning the primary. I guess he still have some stages to go. Let's see if we can maybe push him or Blacks and Latinos and a coalition of progressives can coalesce around pushing him to do the right thing for the citizens of New York. But we're all really in this, we're kind of frozen in amber, right? And these narratives about the city and Blacks and white liberals. And, everyone says this now, right? But it's true, right? Antonio Gramsci, the old is dying, the new cannot yet be born. We really are stuck in this interregnum. And hopefully that will end soon and we'll see the new start to be born.
Well, what's interesting about Raskin as well is that he has overwhelming Black support. He was recently, maybe a year or two ago, given an award by the NAACP for his work on behalf of Black people. And so why is there this disconnect between concrete action by these white liberal politicians and this overwhelming support by Black people? I mean, where is the disconnect coming here from?
Yeah, well, you know, that almost is the subject. No, not almost. It really is the subject of my book, Class War in America, right? White supremacy survives, has survived, and thrived for most of its life here in the United States. Particularly, it has thrived on being able to peel off one layer after another of the working class, or people who would align with the working class, Germans and Italians and Irish at first, right? The Irish came here particularly with an understanding of racism and slavery, and pledged, many of them pledged to cling to the abolitionists, right? But they became white, right? What I mean by that, what I mean is that they became a sort of, and I don't, Europeans, Hungarians and the British and the French and the Portuguese and the Italians, all of them, they are glorious people. White people were created, the invention of whiteness. There were no white people when, if you look at the books from 1619, there were no white people listed, right? It was created to be a scab, to be something apart, to disarticulate solidarity with working class people, particularly of color, right? And so that is not surprising when you understand that history. You know, we're talking a lot about Zionism. Zionism was if not created, it was certainly strengthened after World War II and after the Holocaust. Remember, Hitler targeted the Jews because what? They were what? Considered non-white, number one, and communist, number two, right? And so after World War II, the United States, really all over the world, we saw this even in South Africa, apartheid South Africa in 1948, they gave Jews an opportunity to be white. Not all of them accepted this. There's still this sort of understanding, even today, if you look at Jewish Voices for Peace, if you look at Bernie Sanders and Swerner and Goodman in 1964, who were killed registering blacks to vote, there's this understanding of the Jewish people as healers of the world, right? And there's some real reason to describe them that way. And Zionism is intended to steal the world, right? It's not anti-Semitic, that's Zionism, which has very little to do with Judaism, right? And so when you look at this effort, this very deliberate effort to peel off one layer after another of this progressive working class coalition, in which blacks are the center for obvious reasons, right? We are the most oppressed. It's not surprising that beginning in the late 60s, you saw an effort to target blacks themselves. Beginning in the late 60s with Richard Nixon, the Southern his Southern strategy, but also his ideas about black capitalism, where he peeled off one layer of black elite, created in some ways black elite, and turned them gradually against working class blacks. And so I saw, and I think my generation is most responsible for that shift. I'm a few years younger than Obama. And in the 80s, we saw, of course, you know, Bill Cosby, Oprah, all these institutions, these media institutions, which engaged this war of narratives kind of in the middle, not on one side or another, but kind of in the middle. Well, you know, they do say some things that are correct. So, this is what we're going to have to deal with going forward, is that not all skin folk is kinfolk, as the saying goes. And we need and I'm not urging violence, I'm just saying we need to address that in one way or another. We need to deal with the fact that not all our people are our people.
Well, you know, I wanted just to sort of end the conversation on that note, because I think that is essential. Because, as you know, recently Governor Moore, Westmore, vetoed a bill that would study reparations, not provide reparations for the pain and suffering that we've discussed. And also, he signed a bill that would allow 10-year-olds to be incarcerated. And so you talk about black faces in high places. 1 minute, can you sort of address that issue? And the issue of black faces in high places and the relationship between that and what's happening in the black community. But
I have actually on my own show on WPFW, Short Money, Dissecting Racial Capitalism, talked about Westmore and his decision in the context of black Democrats, black faces in high places, who are sticking to this script developed by Bill Clinton. I remember this as a young reporter at the Washington Post. I came here in 1993 with Bill Clinton. There was a congressman from Illinois named Mel Reynolds, who was the first black politician I remember who was pro-NAFTA, pro the omnibus crime bill. He talked and walked differently. He wasn't attached to the labor unions. He got caught up. He went to Harvard. He was a product of the think tanks, not the labor unions or the neighborhoods. He got caught up in a sex scandal and lost his seat. But he was the first Obama. It was a dry run for Obama. And this is the face of black politicians, mostly Democrats these days, where they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And they're really, I don't think there's any other way to say this, they are meant to be a response to the Marion Barry's, Muriel Bowser here in Washington, D.C. is particularly bad. I just think we have to say that. I call her Mayor 1% after Rahm Emanuel. And so, yeah, it's really something we have to deal with, are these Black faces in high places.
Well, John, thank you so much for this groundbreaking work, your new book. And we look forward to continuing this conversation. Thank you so much.
Me as well. Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you. We will take a short break for the community calendar.
Wednesday, June 25th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur Study Group Session, part two of Building Revolutionary Alternatives to the Capitalist Healthcare System, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info and the request to register is on nocapitalisthealthcarepart2.eventbrite.com. Thursday, June 26th, IPS invites you to the special online screening of the documentary And Yet We Exist, Pero Si Existimos, about a powerful story of resistance against corporate exploitation and environmental harm, the case of Volcan Mining Company versus Mexico ISDS, followed by a live panel discussion, 2 to 4 p.m. More info and registration is on ips-dc.org/events. Also on Thursday, June 26th at 6 p.m., Busboys and Poets on 450 K Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., presents you with a discussion powering anti-war, organizing a fundraiser for Roots Action and Defusing Nuclear War. For more info, visit busboysandpoets.com. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's social justice calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake, WPFW-FM. I'm your host, Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. My next guest is John Steinbeck. John is a longtime independent community activist and writer, coordinator of the Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Committee of the National Capital Area. Welcome to What's at Stake, John.
Yeah, hi, Marcia. Very, very happy to be here.
Thank you. John, could you talk about the history of Iran's nuclear program, including its use of nuclear medical technology?
Sure. Iran's program, nuclear program, began in the 1950s under the Shah. Listeners probably are aware that in 1953, the U.S. government overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh. It was the joint U.S. and Britain. And the reason was that Mossadegh had the nerve to say that he wanted some control over Iran's resources. And of course, the U.S. and Britain, wanted those resources for themselves. And so they essentially took it. They overthrew Mossadegh, threw him in prison where he died in prison, and installed the Shah, who was a brutal dictator, ran with an iron fist. His Savak ran numerous torture dungeons and, assassinations, executions, he was our guy, a very typical story. So in the early 50s, 1954, Eisenhower made a famous Atoms for Peace speech at the UN. And this, by the way, of course, just like everything else, was a propaganda ploy because the U.S. had used nuclear bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing hundreds of thousands of civilians, and Eisenhower wanted to put lipstick on the pig. So he said, we're going to turn nuclear technology for civilian use. And, as long as you don't develop nuclear weapons, we'll give you nuclear technology. So At that time, the United States gave Iran and Israel, by the way, identical 5-megawatt highly enriched uranium reactors. And Iran sent thousands and thousands of their students to U.S. engineering schools to study nuclear technology. The Shah made a declaration that Iran intended to build 36 giant nuclear reactors. And the idea was that they would build nuclear reactors to generate electricity so they would be able to export more oil. And so that was the beginning of the program. Under the Shah, that program expanded. There were plans to build, contracts were signed with France to build 2 reactors in Bushehr. And the Shah also started an early prototype exploration into nuclear weapons. Well, what happened then was the Iranian people got tired. There was a popular revolution. It was an overwhelming revolution. It included the TUDA, the Iranian Communist Party, various social democratic parties, other populist parties, and it included the Muslim community, the mosques, under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini. And so Khomeini ended up being the face of the revolution. And the Islamic revolution took place. The government consolidated. And the Ayatollah was totally opposed to any nuclear bomb effort. And he was also skeptical of nuclear power. So he kind of put an end to nuclear development, but he died in 1989, and that may not be correct. And it was after his death that the Iranians started to re-implement their nuclear program. France had, by the way, had bailed out. So the Soviet Union and Russia came in. They completed the Bashar reactor, which, by the way, is an operating reactor. Israel developed a uranium enrichment technology. They were forced to, because of sanctions, international sanctions, they were forced to generate isotopes for their radiation health program, cancer cures and stuff like that. And so that was where things were. In 2003, Iran abandoned any efforts to develop nuclear weapons. The CIA and the other 17 intelligence agencies ever since then have consistently, up until this very March, Tulsi Gabbard went to Congress and said it is the consensus of all 18 intelligence programs, CIA, NSA, and all the rest of them. It is our consensus that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. And so that's kind of where things are. So when you hear that the reason for these attacks on the nuclear program are because Iran is building a bomb, that flies in the face of every single intelligence agency report for the last 20 plus years, including up to the current time. So the point I want people to understand is when you hear about Iran's nuclear program, that understand that that's not the issue. The issue is very clear, and the issue is regime change. They want to implement, bring back the Shah, or introduce break. Essentially, what they want to do is they want to break Iran up, and basically so that the United States can further control the Middle East even more. And as we reach the end of the age of the oil age, if you will, as oil is becoming more and more expensive and more difficult to find, it's more and more important that the United States controls all of the world's oil. And that's really what it's all about. It's not about democracy. It's not about nuclear weapons. In some sense, it's not even about Israel. It's about control. It's always been about control. And one further thought on this. So, and I think it was John Kerry, maybe, of all people, that made this point. And that is that, you know, even if Iran had a nuclear weapons program, and even if Iran had a nuclear bomb, nothing would change because Israel has on the order of 300 sophisticated hydrogen bombs and a sophisticated delivery system. So whether or not Iran has the bomb is totally irrelevant because Israel is in a position to, you know, absolutely obliterate Tehran with, you know, its 10 million inhabitants. So that's a thumbnail sketch. It's more complex than that, but that's the bottom line.
A recent article from the LA Progressive titled "How the U.S. and Israel Use Rafael Grossi to Hijack the IAEA and Start a War on Iran" by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas Davies details how Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, had collaborated with the Israelis to set the stage of war against Iran. Could you give us a bit of context about what the IAEA is and how or if it has been weaponized by the West to undermine the sovereignty of Iran?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up because actually the last thing last night before I went to bed is I read that article that Medea and Davies wrote. And, you know, it's really quite an exceptional article. But for those of us who study this issue, it's really not new news. So to go back to the 30 years ago, the nuclear powers got together and decided they wanted to maintain their nuclear supremacy. So most of the nations of the world, are pretty rational, and nobody wanted there to be every nation to have a nuclear bomb. That would be kind of nuts. So the idea was, and this was orchestrated by the nuclear powers, that we would have something called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. So the NPT said that the nations of the world, all the nations of the world, would have an unalienable right to develop nuclear technology, but not to develop bomb technology. In return, the deal, the quid pro quo was the nuclear powers pledged that with due speed and haste, that they would implement good faith efforts toward nuclear disarmament. So what happened was that the overwhelming majority of the nations of the world signed it. So today, the only non-signatories are Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. Israel has, from the beginning, never signed the NPT. Part of the NPT was the development of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The role of that agency was to be neutral, to play a totally neutral role, and its assignment was to investigate the nuclear facilities, the nuclear programs, civilian nuclear programs of all the nations in the world that were engaged in nuclear technology, and that was to make certain that they did not develop a bomb program. So from the very beginning, Iran was looked at with suspicion. And so therefore the IAEA had particularly stringent requirements of Iran from the beginning. And from the beginning, Iran had sanctions imposed upon it related to its nuclear program, its unalienable right under the NPT. And so then the investigations of the IAEA of Iran increased more and more and more. And then we had the JCPOA, the Iran agreement under Obama in 2015. And so this was, I would say, reluctantly agreed to by Iran. Certainly there were many in the Iran defense establishment that were very skeptical, because the problem was that Iran was being subjected to unprecedented inspections, not only of their nuclear facilities, but of their other military facilities. And you know, no other nation in the world faced anything remotely like Iran did regarding its nuclear program. And over and over and over and over again, and even up until today, just last month and last week, the IAEA said Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. Now, the listenership is going to be confused, because the mass media was trumpeting this finding by the IAEA that Iran was in violation of the NPT, and, oh my God, they're going to bomb Israel tomorrow. We got to do something. Well, what this was related to was, prior to 2003, documents had emerged that came out of the Mujahideen, many of us expect Mossad had a role in this, saying that there were three sites in Iran where there had been a nuclear weapons program. And so what happened was that the IAEA found traces of enriched uranium at those three spots. There was no program, there was nothing there, but there were traces of enriched uranium. So this is what that was all about. This was about a possible violation back prior to 2003. So it had nothing to do with the program today. So I hope that illuminates, because if you had listened to the mainstream media, including the liberal media, you would think that the big problem in the Middle East and the big problem in the world is Iran's nuclear program, weapons program, that doesn't exist. And in the meantime, we have Israel that has 300 odd sophisticated nuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs, ballistic missiles that can reach New York City, six submarines that can stay submerged for 10 days at a time and have a 10,000 mile range. And Iran is the problem. So people need to understand, every time you're turning on the mainstream media news, you've got to understand that, you know, what you're getting is not necessarily the way things actually really are.
No, I think that's the reason why we have such loyal listenership here at WPFW, because people are so invested in understanding and trying to discern what is the truth, because they're listening to this other narrative on these other channels, and yet it doesn't somehow it's not quite parallel with their understanding of how these processes work. Let me ask you another question. Over the past 2 weeks, the United States and Israel have murdered more than hundreds of civilians, including 14 nuclear scientists, along with their families and nearby innocent civilians who Israel considered, or they're called, collateral damage. Mustafa Sadati Armaki, a nuclear scientist, was killed, along with his wife, two daughters, and a son. What impact do you think these murders will have on Iran's capacity to continue producing nuclear technology?
Well, I think that, you know, I, I mean, I hate to quote the New York Times and Washington Post, but, you know, the headline this morning is that, you know, Iran's nuclear program has been perhaps been put back a few months to a year or so, you know, and even that you have to look at. So, I mean, what happened was that, you know, Iran was very clear about what was going on and I think had enough common sense to see through these so-called, negotiations, ceasefire negotiations and so on. And so months ago, and I would even dare say even probably a year or more ago, Iran started shutting down their nuclear facilities and moving out all the enriched uranium and moving out the centrifuges and moving out the other technology. So Einstein said, you know, famously, when the U.S. had a nuclear monopoly in 1946 and 1947, and was trying to prevent the world from getting it, that there is no nuclear secret. It's purely a technological thing. And today, there are, arguably, 12 to 20 threshold nuclear states that have enrichment capacity and could, within a fairly short time, develop a nuclear weapon. So Iran is only one of those. So in that sense, the cat is out of the bag. These attacks. Larry Johnson, 2-3 days ago, was on one of the big talk shows. And, Larry's former top level CIA, kind of like he's a friend of Ray McGovern's. He and Ray McGovern formed the intelligence officers for sanity or something. And Larry Johnson said 3 days ago that everything that we were seeing was kind of kabuki theater and had been orchestrated. And it turns out apparently that he was right. Apparently there were backstage negotiations going on and that all of this was orchestrated. But I think it's important to understand that everything that we've seen in the last week has been orchestrated in order to save Israel, because Israel over the last week has been under an unprecedented attack. You can go on video on YouTube. You won't see this on the New York Times or CNN or MSNBC, but there are parts of downtown Haifa. There are parts of downtown Tel Aviv that kind of look like Gaza. And, one of the major oil refineries has been taken out. The port of Haifa is basically non-functional at this point. So, Israel was, and the reason for that was the modern missile technology that is prevalent. Many nations have relatively modern missile technology. They're more accurate. They're more destructive. That was what was going on, is that Israel's famous Iron Dome was an iron colander, and the missiles were getting through, particularly the newer ballistic missiles were getting through. And so that was why, essentially, boiling it all down, Israel called uncle, that they could not possibly withstand that. If, you know, think about this, Israel is a tiny nation, smaller than New Jersey, population of maybe 9 million people. Iran is 30 times larger and has a population of 90,000. So I don't need to wrap. Everybody, I think, gets the point. So
I thank you. This is invaluable information. And back on to continue to update us, because obviously this problem is not going away. So I thank you. I thank you so much for the interview, and I thank you for your long years of activism in our community. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to thank my guests, John Jeter and John Steinbeck. We are celebrating the 23rd year of the passage of the first civil rights whistleblower law of the 21st century, No Fear. This show is engineered by Katia Stitt. The executive producer is Verna Avery Brown. The segment with John Steinbeck was produced by Ari Gutman. I am Marcia Coleman Adebayo. Thank you. No fear.
of possession is the motivation that is hanging up the goddamn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut. Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what. Slaughterhouses are killing hogs. Twisted children are killing frogs. Poor dumb rednecks rolling logs. Tired old ladies kissing dogs. I hate the human love of that stinking mud. I can't use it. Trying to make it real compared to what. Come on, baby.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
On Monday, June 30th, WPFW presents The House That Wanda Built 2025, our annual Pride special programming. From 2 p.m. until midnight, WPFW will broadcast voices from the Inside Out Collective and beyond, discuss issues affecting the LGBTQIA+ community, and present music from the Anthology of Booty and the Ladies Room, honoring the life and legacy of Washington, D.C.'s beloved Black lesbian activist Wanda Alston. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of